Well, it's terrific to see you all here. A little intimidating, but very nice. I always think of these talks as being more like conversations, which is kind of hard to do with such a big group. But I promise you there'll be plenty of time for questions and comments and so on. I'm not going to take up the whole time talking, but I'll take up a good deal of it. So the title of this talk is The Blue Box, Five Lives in Letters. Actually, it's going to be called Three Lives in Letters, because some of the material that I'm going to be talking about tonight, my editor decided didn't really fit. And I can explain that to you later. I think her reasons were very good, although I was terribly sorry to lose two of the five lives. So what I'd like to do is open up a conversation with all of you about the fascinating and vital question of the difference between fiction and nonfiction. Question that's very much in the air today. In fact, Robert Caro in the New York Times recently said that he felt the boundary between fiction and nonfiction was what he called porous. I don't really agree. When I approach writing history, as I am with this book, I do use all my tools as a fiction writer, and I think many writers of history need those tools because they are what add color and life to the account. This book, The Blue Box, Three Lives in Letters, is going to be published by Sarabande Books here in Louisville in 2014, which seems a long time off. And after I've talked about that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the next biography, which is something I'll be working on probably for the next 3 years. Thanks to my sister Eleanor Miller, I'm sure a lot of you know her, and to my niece Emily Bingham, who I'm very pleased to say is here tonight, I was given the priceless opportunity 3 years ago to examine the contents of a large blue box, which Eleanor had discovered at the top of our mother's closet when she was cleaning out the house after mother's death. And I'm sure many of you here have had the experience of finding something unexpected when you're cleaning out a house and perhaps not knowing what to do with it. Anyway, Eleanor did know what to do with it, and she and Emily offered the box to me, and as you can imagine, I pounced on it. The actual handling of actual pieces of paper is a revelation. The feel of the creases in old letters, the smell of that acid-free notepaper, the look of ancient stamps and postmarks, the scent of ink that has kept its depth of tone, and then, of course, the handwriting, at times impossible. My 12-year-old granddaughter, Iona Ellsworth, whose eyes are sharper than mine, had to decipher the schoolboy letters of her great-grandfather when I really couldn't read them. And she gets noted in the acknowledgement. She's quite pleased about that. In addition to these letters and papers from the blue box, I began to read through my parents' files here at the Filson. With expert help from the archivist and an atmosphere both welcoming and professional. And since this was a new field of endeavor for me, I was particularly grateful for the help that I received here. So I began the adventure of reconstructing the lives of these long-forgotten women relatives, my great-grandmother, for whom I'm named, my grandmother, and my mother. She's not long forgotten, using skills honed during my career as a writer of fiction. I want to say right away that I don't invent dialogue or internal monologue or scenes and characters that are not based on the evidence at hand. This simple distinction is crucial, I think, to maintaining the integrity of both fiction and nonfiction. And when fiction takes the upper hand, as it has in two recent highly successful historical novels, which I won't name, but you may guess what I'm talking about, the reader is deprived of the reliability that only facts, however transformed, can bestow. I should add there that we all know facts are not that reliable either, since they depend on the eyes of the person reporting them. However, by facts, I mean something pretty simple. I mean dates, names, places. Nothing much more than that, because beyond that, even with what we call facts, we're getting into interpretation. And that's where, of course, all the issues lie. But as readers, the first thing we deserve in reading nonfiction is at least that limited form of reliability. As I began to sort through the contents of the blue box, I soon came across a slim, ivory-colored pamphlet titled Old Record of the Captivity of Margaret Erskine, 1779, published by the Lord Baltimore Press in Baltimore in 1912. Inside the cover, in her inimitable handwriting, my mother wrote to Eleanor this account of her great-great-grandmother's capture by the Indians. I was fascinated, especially since I had never heard of Margaret or her captivity, which is quite remarkable. The account had been written by Senator Allen T. Caperton, who was 32 years old at the time of his grandmother's death. He writes that he based his account on the story she told him. I was dismayed. Why? I have a great deal of experience in the way women's voices across the ages and even today have been co-opted, often by people whose motives are of the best, but who may be influenced by concerns about privacy, scandal, and so forth, or who may not be able to capture the flavor of a woman's voice. Margaret lived at a time in the late 18th century when women rarely wrote their own reminiscences. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, in her wonderful book, Good Wives, states that of the 300 men, women, and children taken by the Indians from northern New England towns in the 18th century, the women left no written record. So, what was Margaret's actual experience of her capture and her 4 years of captivity? We have only a few details as her grandson recorded them. The Shawnee Indians, who captured Margaret, were known for their relatively humane treatment of captives compared to the Plains Indians, who raped and murdered savagely. But crying infants and the infirm were executed by all the tribes, and Margaret's infant suffered the same fate. According to Caperton, an old Indian caught it by its heels, dashing its brains out against a tree, and flung it on the ground at her feet. This brutality makes it even more remarkable that Margaret managed not only to survive, but even to thrive during her 4 years in a Shawnee town on the Miami River. And in all the captivity accounts I have read, that is one of the longest periods of time that anyone spent with the Indians. Usually they either escaped or were ransomed after 2 or 3 years. 4 years was a very long time. Here's how Caperton describes it. After much deliberation, she was adopted into the family of the great chief, whose English name was White Bark. He gave her with his own hand a belt of wampum as an emblem of her adoption and named her Yellow Gold, presumably for her hair. During her captivity, Margaret made friends with the Indian women, usually quite hostile to female captives, and was called Little Ship Under Full Sail for her cheerful and energetic demeanor, a nickname that would pass to her great-granddaughter, Emily Stiles, founder of the American Girl Scouts. So you can see there's a line. 4 years later, when Margaret was finally ransomed, Caperton writes, she shed tears, tears of mingled joy and sorrow. The Indian women mourned her departure and begged her to leave her son, born in captivity, with them, but she refused to leave without the little boy. Soon she was on her way back to the settlement in what today is West Virginia. Although Caperton's account seems balanced and perhaps reliable, I am aware of what he would have needed to leave out, or at least to minimize, to suit the conventions of his time. His grandmother's actual relationship with her captors, which might have collided with his beliefs about the savage Indians. Particularly difficult to explain would be the parentage of her son John, born in captivity. With this in mind, I decided to include parts of Caperton's account in my book, The Blue Box, but to take the risk, and it is a risk, of writing an additional chapter from Margaret's point of view. You will understand my dilemma. Am I justified in recreating Margaret's story, or am I merely substituting one prejudice for another? Today's noble savage replacing the barbarian of earlier eras. That Margaret never called the Shawnee barbarians or savages, never called on God to deliver her, and wept when she was ransomed, is this enough evidence for my imagination to feed on? You will have to be the judges. I'm going to read you now a short selection from this longer chapter that I wrote, which my editor, in her wisdom, decided to exclude. It's called Margaret Tells Her Story. Her family has crowded into her small, dark, low-ceilinged room, its floor scuffed and scored from years of gatherings, the great stone fireplace blackened with pitch smoke. She hears their murmured greetings, feels their soft, dry lips brush her forehead, collects their good wishes like apples in her lap. Only the littlest grandchildren hang back and must be pushed forward for the kiss. She holds each one an instant, examining it. Will you listen to my story? They are, of course, too young to make a sensible reply. Alan's pen is poised over his notebook. Are you going to write me? She asks. It should be recorded, grandmother, Alan says. It's history, a daughter says. A long time ago now, another pipes up. 20 years, Margaret says. Take your notes. I'll be dead and gone by the time they're in covers. A long time ago, she had thought of writing her own book, but it would not have been appropriate. Now listen, she says. They stir, settling. She leans forward, thin as a stick, fire in her eyes. We left Monroe in September 1779, riding west towards the Cumberland Mountains, she begins. The good land across the Ohio was opened up to settlers after the Iroquois signed that treaty. We didn't know, my husband and I, that the Shawnee claimed it was their land and the Iroquois had no right to sign it away. Hardly their land, her son William says. You can say it was God's all along, she tells him. But in that case, it is God's still. That brings a pause. We knew there had been a great fight years earlier, she goes on, when Lord Dunmore's men built the fort on the Kanawha and Cornstalk sent 1,000 warriors to drive them out. Oh, tell about Cornstalk, the littlest girl able to listen whispers. Not yet, miss. I hadn't even met him. But the fight ended when the Virginia militia burned some Shawnee villages across the Ohio and they came to terms. The Treaty of Fort Stanwyck, Alan explains. I don't care what it was called, Margaret says, but it made me feel safe to start out. And so we did, riding along the mountains to find the gap where we could cross, a party of 11, my husband, my little child. How old was she? Daisy, the oldest of the granddaughter, asks. I'll thank you not to interrupt. Little Margaret was 3 years old that September, my first child, she said. I carried her in my lap so I could feed her. Their silence seems to thicken around her, and she presses through it forcefully. We expected no trouble. We rode in single file on the trace through the trees that were golden in the late afternoon sun. I cantered ahead of my husband and the others. And then there was a shot, insisted a ground child. Ooh, squeals the little girl who asked about the baby. I heard my husband calling me, Margaret says, to turn back, but the shot had frightened my horse and she sprang forward. An Indian jumped from behind a tree, jerked me down, and struck me senseless with a club. When I came to, I saw my infant lying a little ways off and took her in my arms, but her crying aroused the rage of the Indian, who snatched her from me and dashed her head against a tree. She sighs. The old wound, so long healed or at least scarred over, throbs once. Then they forced me onto my horse, she says, and led me off, leaving the body of my babe on the ground to be devoured by wolves. A humming silence, and then more exclamations. We rode in the direction of the Bluestone in the East River a good part of the way, one of the Indians leading my horse. Rode all day and all night, and I suffered much because of falls. At night, they took my shoes away, and I slept in their midst. What did they feed you? A daughter asks. They shared whatever they had, a scrap of dried meat and some parched corn. Finally, when they were nearly starving, they shot and butchered my horse. They gave me some meat nearly raw and boiled her bones for a broth. Ugh, Elizabeth says on cue. You would not believe how good it tasted, Margaret says. She breathes a little, starting again. The Indian that killed my baby was kinder to me than the others. There is an outcry. She expects it and turns to poking the fire and calling for another log. A woman she doesn't recognize explains, "Do you mean regret? He showed Christian remorse?" "Is it not in our common nature to regret?" Margaret says. "Our," someone says, disbelieving. Margaret goes on evenly, "And you must remember, for them, a crying babe was impractical. It would have alerted our pursuers." Alan throws another log on the fire, and the sparks fly up. Margaret goes on, "The next day we continued westward through the wilderness. When we reached the Ohio, the Indians swam our horses across, their shoulders above the swift currents. How strong they were. Now, there is merely silence." Then across the Scioto in the same manner, and then the Miami. When we came in sight of their town, they fired their guns and shouted to announce their return with a prisoner, plunder, and scalps. They came running from the village, shouting and rejoicing. After offering me his hand, one of the warriors struck me a blow that laid me on the earth. At that, their chief became enraged and interposed for my protection, which saved me. I was taken before the council, and it was decided that I would be adopted into the family of my protector, a great chief, and I was given a wampum belt. The feeling of the beads under her fingers brings back the sharp smell of smoke in the council lodge. Cornstalk's adopted daughter, Elizabeth says comfortingly, patting her mother's hand. Well, that's an example of what nobody but you will ever read. Well, I think in this case, I'm going to go on to the next book, which, since the Blue Box won't be out until 2014, I think we're looking at least 2016. This is going to be probably a 2 to 3 year project. I don't yet have a book contract. I need a book contract before I launch into further research. But it does have a tentative title, which I think it will retain. It's called Make It New. Doris Duke and the Invention of the Modern Woman. Now, some of you here...
I'll give you a book contract.
All right. I'll take you up on it. I know some of you here heard stories about Doris Duke. Certainly we all know about the Doris Duke Foundation, one of the three largest foundations in terms of endowment in this country, very, very actively involved in the arts, in conservation, in modern dance, in Islamic studies. Three great houses, which I'm looking forward to visiting, one in Newport, one in Somerville, New Jersey, one in Hawaii, all devoted to issues of conservation and history. But what you may have heard or may have remembered hearing about Doris Duke, who died in 92, has very little to do with that. So this was the way this happened. 6 months ago, by another extraordinary act of good fortune, 800 linear feet of paper files, the Doris Duke Archive at Duke University in Durham, was opened, and I was given access to all of it, including the restricted folders. And I had decided from the beginning that if the foundation was not willing to give me access to the restricted folders, I wouldn't be able to write the book, because what I was not interested in doing was some kind of a whitewash job. Now, they have not given me access to the medical folders, and that's a bridge I have yet to cross, because I think there are issues that probably I can only find out about in the medical folders. But as I say, that's a bridge I have yet to cross. Giving me access, unlimited access, in this way on the part of a great university and a great foundation, was a real gift for me. I've had a long and very fruitful connection with Duke University. As you know from the introduction, I started an archive there 20 years ago for women's papers and history, which thrives and continues to hold the papers, particularly of women writers and organizations of women in the South. Doesn't yet really rival the Schlesinger at Radcliffe or the archive at Smith, but I think it will one of these days. So that was how they knew me and felt, I think, because they had known me for 20 years, that perhaps I was the person who should finally write this biography. As I began to read letters written to Doris Duke in the 1930s, those were in the first files, I realized that the archive holds only one side of this voluminous correspondence. In this case, Doris Duke kept, I think, every letter that was ever written to her from the time she was a child until she died. But those people to whom she wrote apparently did not keep her letters, although there are many complaints that she wouldn't write. So it may be there never were any letters, or very few of them. She was self-conscious about her lack of education. She had a few years of schooling in New York at Brearley, but nothing beyond that. I don't think she graduated from high school, and she certainly never went to college. So she was self-conscious about her writing, and that may have been the reason why there just actually never were very many letters. But if there were any, these correspondents who wrote her voluminously over a long period of time didn't keep her letters, or those letters were lost. These were people who were not famous and well known as she was. So again, I lack her voice. Again, I am beginning to imagine what that voice might be like, the voice of a woman of extraordinary height, 6 feet 1 inch, at a period when the average height of women was 5 feet 4 inches. That in itself, I think, is very significant, because even today, if a woman that tall walks into the room, it is a different impression. Enormously wealthy from the age of 12 when her father died and left her basically everything he had made as the great tobacco baron of central North Carolina. And she was also gifted with an extraordinary generosity that developed slowly during the course of her life, I think, that is enshrined in the Doris Duke Foundation, which she endowed in her will with $1.3 billion. The foundation supports the causes she cared about: modern dance, theater, conservation, and Islamic arts, which she became very interested in late in her life. as well as the three great houses open to the public, which I mentioned. She was also a woman pursued by scandal. It's incredible, even in the first stages of this research, because I've only barely begun, really, the amount of gossip that she generated. This, her era, was the era of the gossip columnists in the New York newspapers like Charlie Knickerbocker. And it seemed as though her name was cropping up just about every week. Sometimes something innocuous, such as that she was at a party. Sometimes something not at all innocuous, like a mysterious death that occurred and which was never really explained. And by her late middle age, she was so terrified of the press that she would literally hide from reporters and threaten them in unseemly ways if they did take a picture of her, and I think became really haunted and almost obsessed by the kind of publicity that she was generating. Lacking her voice, how far can I go with this recreation? Well, my biography, based on all these documents, as well as careful contextual research, have the validity of other biographies of other people that can quote their main subjects extensively. Can I fill the gap again with my imagination, as I did with Margaret Erskine and Carolyn Stiles? This is my challenge, and I'll use my skills as a fiction writer and my long practice in observing and attempting to understand women's lives to recreate the life of a woman who may turn out to be a fabulous monster. That's my challenge. I hope the next time I see all of you, this book will have been written and I can tell you some more about it. Thank you so much.